I mean, the way some guys do it, they got a piece of plastic with a hole on the right side and the left side that the dipole winds through. The coax cable comes into the bottom and is bound there by some kind of a technique. And another hole in the top of the plastic where the, in your case, the nylon cord is suspended from. Is that approximately what you did mechanically to the center of the dipole? Over to you, Jeff.
All my antennas are made the same way, obviously different lengths, but it's the same same approach. It's the device is called a Budwig, you know, it's very easy. You've got the two connectors for your legs of the dipole and SO239. That's going to it. It's designed as a center connector of a dipole. And as I say, I've got dipoles for all the different low bands. And this, of course, that's the only one that's in the inverted V configuration. They all seem to work with no problems, except this one, which. As I said, did not load at all, Dick. Go ahead.
KC2QAQ. Is Budwig a brand name? Is that something that's sold by MFJ, so to speak? I'll get to you a second, Glenn. Go ahead, Jeff.
Yes, Budwig is a brand name, and I buy them at HRO, Ham Radio Outlet. Go ahead, Dick.
You got it, Glenn. KC2QIQ. What do you think is happening, Glenn?
Yeah, good evening, Dick. I don't think the gutter or the Budwig or any of that's the problem at all. But I just have one quick question. How far are the tips of the dipole from the ground? In other words, when you're bringing it down to an inverted V, you must be terminating the end of the wire. How close is it to the ground, and electrically, in length, is it attached to the ground? Is it attached to a fence? In other words, explain me how the end is attached as it goes down to ground level. KC2QIQ.
You've got it, Jeff.
Okay, KC2QIQ. Here's the answer. One leg is connected to a broomstick handle, a wooden broomstick handle, which is connected to a fence, a wire fence, and that would be about about 7 feet off the ground. The other leg is connected to obviously it's connected to an insulator and the other end of the insulator is connected to the broomstick handle. The other leg is again an insulator, obviously, and the other end of the insulator is connected to a mast, which is the mast is connected to a wire fence. That mast is at the top of the mast is another a different antenna. Back to you, Dick.
Does that give you any hints, Glenn?
Well, I think the height of the inverted V is very, very low, which is a problem for performance. But I don't even think that that's the issue here. What I think is really going on is that you can't even load this thing. And I think what's really happening is that the tips, where the tips are coming down, in other words, your loading end, where you're attaching the SO239 connector, is not seeing a balanced configuration back where you're plugging the coax in. So a bound may actually help you here. In other words, if you would attach a balanced structure or a pair of twin lead and a tuner might actually help you out. But I think what's really happening is that when you're bringing those lines down to either the fence area or to the mast on the other end, that it's just a very, very unbalanced, loaded impedance at the ends that the antenna really doesn't want to see. You could probably get another, like, wooden pole and try to lift it higher and higher, and it'll probably get better. But I think if you want to leave it mechanically the way it is, a balun might be a better solution. Back to you, Dick, K2RW, KC2QIQ.
Yeah, maybe you tuned a little bit late, Glenn. The mystery here is that he had an extremely high VISWAR when he fed it in a normal manner. He put a 1-to-1 balance, in other words, this MFJ device, 1-915 RF isolator, 1-to-1 balance, with an SO239 on both ends. He put that balance in the shack at the output connector of the antenna tuner into the transmission line, and then everything were loaded beautifully. That's the mystery. And so, as you can tell, Glenn, this is not a simple one. KC2QIQ, K2RIW.
Dick, I don't think it's a mystery. I think that that's exactly what I would expect to happen. In other words, the problem right now is that the antenna, in other words, whether it's a dipole, an inverted V, basically the low impedance is by the feed points because it's coaxial fed in the center. And the impedance is going towards the end is going to be the high end. Where he has the high end of the antenna, he's got it very, very close to the ground level. One near a wire fence on one side, one near a wire fence on the other side. And the two wire fences probably don't look similar to each other. So one is probably loading a little bit more to ground than the other side. So the antenna is probably heavily imbalanced the way that it's mechanically mounted. So the balance is actually basically trying to straighten out the imbalance in the antenna to allow it to match. K2RIW, KC2QIQ.
Okay, that's an interesting sounding theory you've got there, Glenn. I know that Scott wants to give us some words on this one. Scott, I wonder if the guys in the Golden Horseshoe of Canada have ever run into this one. VE3ZTZ, K2RIW.
AA2N.
Good evening to all on the net. Scott from Toronto, Canada, VE3ZTZ returning. Well, I'm not much of an HFer these days, but back in my CB days on the 11 meters when we played with inverted Vs and all the reading I've done since for camping, is there not a relationship between the angle of the V as it departs from a straight line or 180 degrees that you need to shorten the transmission line up as you increase the angle towards 45 degrees and not more than 55 degrees off the feed line entry point? And what I think in terms of the match here is that before he added the balun anywhere in the line, if he didn't shorten the leads, the electrical view of the leads is that as you bring them together, they get longer wavelength-wise. And so he was probably too far out of match for his antenna tuner to work, and that by adding the balun that close to the tuner, it's actually tuning up the balun quite nicely. And then enough energy is radiating that he's seeing that the antenna is working. But I would go back first and if he's got somebody with an analyzer or something to sweep it, and I think you'll find he's not operating quite in the band that he thinks he is, because the straight out dipole, the leads are one measurement, and as you bend them down, they're supposed to get a little shorter, if I'm not mistaken. V3, that these are back to group.
Very fine, Scott. When it comes to an inverted V, there are various people who believe that because it deviates from the usual picture of a half-wave dipole, a flat-out piece of wire completely parallel to the ground at some high altitude, that's the picture we always see in the books. And the inverted V, we think it's a great big deviation from that. From my point of view, it's a very minor deviation. And whether you slope them, the two sides down 10 degrees, 20 degrees, 45 degrees, if you make the apex angle 90 degrees, which is about as severe as anybody would go, at a reasonable altitude in a clear environment where there isn't a whole lot of metal of fences and gutters and downspout tubing and other things around. If it's a reasonably clear environment, reasonably high altitude, an inverted V is extremely forgiving. As I go from flat out to a 90 degree apex angle where I'm slanting each side down 45 degrees, that's going to make an extremely minor difference in the center frequency and the standing wave ratio. So that's my experience. But I guess each guy who hangs an inverted V and he's putting it in a cluttered environment with nearby trees that have got a lot of healthy sap inside and metal fences and whatever. Somehow, for all we know, the metal fence hit resonance. I'm glad that the Ballon did it, but there's still a bit of a mystery here, Jeff. Glad you brought it to our attention. Glad that you found a solution. And someday, if I was in your neighborhood, I'd like to visit and actually see that antenna, because it defies the things that I hold to be true, if you know what I mean. Thank you for bringing that to us, Jeff. We got to move on. I know that other people want to sign in, and I'm not letting anybody else sign in this late, because we've already got two people ahead, and we're falling out of schedule. We got Joe RYY and Don AA2N in that repeater. Time out. As I was starting to say, those two guys in that order are already in the wings, if you know what I mean. Joe, W-A-2-R-Y-Y, I hope you're still with us. K-2-R-I-W in the TechNet. Go right ahead, Joe.
Yeah, I'm here. Are you transmitting directly on 2 meters? Are you transmitting on, like, the east input or something? You got some weird background noise behind you, by the way.
Yeah, I'm hearing the background noise. The static is what you're hearing. And I'm on 2 meters right now. I was on another frequency earlier. Looks like I'm clean right now, Joe. Go right ahead, Joe. You're sounding good.
Okay, this question has to do with fiber optics. Are you up on your fiber optics this week?
You're the guy that's worked with fiber optics. I've never worked with it. I'm far from an expert in this one, Joe. But we'll wing it, and there's a lot of other people listening who are working with fiber optics, like TPN, among others. So one way or another, we'll get you an answer. You got it, Joe. Wait for the four beeps.
Okay, here you go. Well, this might be a simple one for you, maybe not. According to, let's say Google, the speed of light is 299.792.458 meters per second. Okay, remember that number. If you take other frequencies that are used in fiber optic systems, I'll give you an example, like on the ITU, what they call ITU Grid C, 100G spacing, and they'll use, you can write these numbers down and even figure out what calculator, so just so you'll have them, you'll see what I'm talking about here. The frequency they give you and the wavelength does not match if you multiply them backwards to give you the velocity. In other words, on channel 1, for example, it says the operating frequency is 190.100 gig, so 190,100 gig. Wavelength 1577.03 nanometers. You got that one so far?
190,100 was, I think, the frequency in gigs. And give me the wavelength again.
1577.03 nanometers.
Okay, 1577.03 nanometers. And when you put the two together, you will not come out 2.99792458 exponential 8 meters per second, roughly 3 exponential 8 meters per second, because everything other than vacuum has a velocity factor. I don't know what the equivalent, in the case of fiber optics, they don't call it dielectric constant, although it really is. They call it refractive index. But mathematically, they're very similar. Not exactly the same, but very similar. So in most of the dielectric you and I use in coaxial cable, we have something like 69%, 66%, 70% of velocity factor in coax. In the case of the fiber, where the glass is a hell of a lot more dense than air, than vacuum, there's going to be a velocity factor. And I'll bet you it's something in the vicinity of 70%. In other words, I bet when you did that calculation, you came up with what you thought was something like a 30% error. That's my guess, Joe. To be 2RYY, K2RIW, wait for the four beeps.
Well, Dick, since you're good with a calculator, if you multiply those two together, I got an answer of 299.793.403. Okay, let's take the second pair of frequencies, second frequency. This is from channel 20. See, they don't match, okay? You'll see what I'm getting at here. Second frequency on channel, what they call channel 20 from the same chart, 192.000 gig. And the wavelength they call it on the chart is 1561.42. Okay? That one multiplies out to 299.792.640. It's actually higher than the velocity of the speed of light, apparently in a vacuum. So I don't quite understand that. That's how that multiplies out. I'll give you another one, like a third one, for an example, what they call channel 40. 194.000 is the frequency in gig. Wavelength, 1545.32 nanometers. I got an answer, 299.792.080. So you see, something's changing here, and I'm just trying to understand. So it's sort of a curiosity question. I'm just trying to understand what's changing, why something's not a constant here.
Okay, I do not believe all of those numbers. In other words, somebody knew one of the pieces of information. He really did know the wavelength, or he really did know the frequency. I'm going to assume that. Then he took the number 29979 approximately and divided one into the other and came up with a prediction for the other number. For these numbers to be real, you're trying to tell me the glass has a velocity factor of almost exactly the speed of light in a vacuum. And that glass is far from a vacuum. It's got a hell of a lot more dielectric constant or refractive index. So, in my opinion, these are made up numbers. One of those numbers, the guy who wrote that spec sheet knew what it was. He either knew the frequency or he knew the wavelength. I'm going to guess he knew the frequency because it's in gigahertz. But maybe not. And then he calculated the other. He didn't really measure it. And it's a calculation with error in his calculation, is my guess. I'm having great difficulty believing that that fiber gives you a 99.99% velocity factor. I'll bet you it's a hell of a lot closer to 70% velocity factor. Therefore, you should have gotten not a 1% error, you should have gotten a 30% error, so to speak, is my guess on this one, Joe. I know we're not going to resolve this one tonight, but you've got a bit of a mystery there, and we got to dig a little bit deeper. To me, 2RYY, wait for the beeps, K2RIW.
KC2, QIQ.
Sound right.
Go ahead, Glenn. I heard three people. Glenn first. Go ahead, Glenn.
Yeah, just like you said earlier, Dick, the only time that the speed of light is constant for all frequencies of light is going to be in a vacuum. Now, when you have cables, especially cables that are designed specifically for passing...
Repeater, timeout. Repeater, timeout. Cancel.
Dick, the wavelength sound correct. Okay, so I think you're saying, Eric, that you recognize those channel numbers, you recognize the wavelength, and because they're not really deriving it by way of frequency synthesis and whatever, therefore he calculated the frequencies in gigahertz, but it's not real is what I think you're saying, Eric. Glenn, you didn't wait for the beeps, and that was all timeout. We missed every bit of that, unfortunately. But because the fiber optic is trying to guide this wave, either by way of graduated refractive index, in other words, it's got more dielectric constant in the center than it does at the perimeter, and a very slow change between the two, but that's a so-called single-mode fiber. But in order for it to guide that wave, it's got to have a velocity factor a hell of a lot less than the speed of light in a vacuum. I think that's what you're saying, Eric. KE2EJ, K2LIW in the TechNet.
But you beat his yes.
K2LIW, K2EJ there. The 1577 is a standard wavelength that's used in WDM. It's usually 1610. It depends. If you're doing wave division multiplexes, a whole bunch of frequencies are very standard. The 1577 is the green light. That's a standard wavelength. And from what I remember, the velocity factor runs somewhere between, depending upon the type of fiber and the material that it's made, it runs anywhere from like 55% to around 70%.
That makes a lot of sense, Eric. Steve, WB2CSE, I believe you work with fiber, and I bet you've got some direct experience on this. Over to you, Steve. Wait for the four beeps.
Only a little bit.
The velocity factor, I know it depends on the fiber, is like Eric said, between 0.5 and 0.7. There was a recent development in Europe where they were working with fiber with a hollow center, and it upped the velocity factor considerably. I don't remember what the article said, but it was enough so that your internet connection would be noticeably quicker.
KC2QIQ.
Glenn recognized, and I'll pass it back to you, Glenn, in a minute. I hold in my hand the May issue 2013 of Laser Focus World. And so the May issue 2013, on the front cover, is this beautiful looking thing called Hollow Core Fibers Go Single Moded, page 31. So there's a whole article on these brand new kinds of very low loss, very high efficiency hollow core fiber, which of course is a little bit equivalent to what happens when you flip over from RG8 cable with polyethylene dielectric with a 66% velocity factor, and you go over to almost airline Andrew Air Heliax, and your velocity factor goes up a whole lot. Instead of 66%, it gets more like 85 or 90% as you get closer and closer to air. And so these hollow core air-like, or maybe it's dry nitrogen filled, they're going to be a bit faster. Still, they're going to be a long distance away from speed of light in vacuum. If you're guiding that wave, you can't guide it with speed of light in a vacuum. Because if it was speed of light in the vacuum, you'd have a transmitting antenna, a receiving antenna, and nothing but vacuum in between. There would be no guiding. You wouldn't be able to put it in the manholes and whatever. It wouldn't work. So I'm still convinced these are phony numbers. Let's see what Glenn's going to say in this one. And do wait for the four beeps this time, Glenn. KC2QIQ, K2LIW in the TechNet.
WB2CSE.
We're going to go to Glenn first and then Steve in that order. Go ahead, Glenn.
Okay, let's see if I've got it this time. Okay. Actually, what I was saying before, Dick, is that with companies like Verizon, they use these kinds of cables all the time, and they're tuned for frequency. Verizon will use like three different frequencies of light, and the problem is they'll actually run three separate networks, and they're very, very concerned about the timing distance as the signal goes down between one repeater prism to the next and from one location to the next. So what they do is when they create the cable, actually what they'll do is they'll design for three bands of color within one cable. And the way that they actually set and design the cable up is so that the velocity for three separate bands will actually equal the same velocity factor. It's a very, very interesting thing. This is not something that's brand new. Now, I mean, I know that the hollow core is for single band light, but actually they do it even with multi-band, and that's where generally they give you the correction factors. In other words, what they're trying to show you is that when you're trying to run multi-band through the one cable, what is the difference between the two? So the number that you're really reading there is what's the difference between the bands, and for a correction factor that has to be done in a prism at the end. KC2QIQ.
It's going to be Steve and Eric in that order. And when they talk about wavelengths, they're talking about what the wavelength would have been in free space. Maybe that's what they're saying, in vacuum. Or when they talk about frequency, what the frequency would have been in free space if that wavelength had been measured in free space. But in the cable, in the real fiber, those combinations of numbers don't ring true to me. Laser Focus World, what is it now called? Yeah, Laser Focus World, page 31, where they talk about this hollow core fibers. They talk about something called PRISM, PRISM, Perpetual Resonance for Improved Single Modeness, PRISM. Looks like an interesting article if you're into fiber. Let's see what Steve has to say about this one. WB2CSE, K2RIW, go ahead, Steve.
I wanted to comment on Glenn's comment. Was Verizon uses WDFS? basically will split it up into the three bands of light. They're light amplifiers, or they're amplifiers, if you want to call it that. It's not, in essence, have delay lines to compensate for the velocity factor before they stick it into a Herschel wedge and pump more light into it. A fiber amplifier is basically a light source in a Herschel wedge, whereas the Herschel wedge maintains the modulation component, and you inject more light into it, and away you go. So that way they come out in time through each one of these repeaters. There's a very specific length of cable where they have to be placed. It's got to be precise, and that's what they do. QTRWK3J.
Good on. Eric, you said WDFM about three times. Tell us what those four letters stand for.
I'm sorry, it's WDM, Wave Division Multiplex.
It makes sense. And these many gigahertz of bandwidth that they're getting out of these fibers and the extremely low insertion loss, you know, a couple of dB per kilometer, sometimes 1.5 dB per kilometer. The world is going to go fiber. I do remember the Bell Laboratories back in roughly 1971. They thought in those days the TE01 mode of a microwave at roughly 200 gigahertz that we're going to run a 250,000 conversations down a 2-inch diameter pipe was what they were proposing for their interstation communication network wideband. 250,000, I think it was, telephone conversations in a pipe. And the project didn't go very far, and it would have really been obsoleted by fiber, but it didn't go very far because, let me drop. They soon realized that when you got a large enough diameter pipe and you're in the TE01 circular waveguide mode, a very exotic mode, very difficult to launch, and yes, you get extremely low loss, if and only if the pipe is absolutely straight. It is an extremely intolerant mode where the most minor bend or bubble or dent in the pipe starts launching other modes that start competing with you and whatever. So on paper, it was a beautiful concept, and in a carefully controlled laboratory experiment where you make an extremely precise 2-inch diameter pipe and with all kinds of fancy structures, you launch this TE01 mode. So in the laboratory, it looked great. Never became a deployed project for a whole bunch of reasons. To try to sink 2-inch diameter pipes across the United States as opposed to these tiny little fibers that we're stringing through manholes underground in our metro areas, the degree of difficulty between the two is like 1,000 to 1. By modern standards, that never would have worked. And with any further comments on this one before I pass it back to Joe, give me your call letters right now, K2LIW in the Tech Net.
I just wanted to say that the limitation in the fibers today is really not the fiber, it is the transmitter and receiver. That's where the bandwidth limitations are.
Yeah, I don't know if it's still true, but there was something called the OC192 standard, which was a kind of modulator used on fiber, where it would tolerate with extremely high fidelity 10 gigabits per second. And I think there was an OC384 standard, 40 gigabits per second, as the modulator. And the company I was working for at the time, Airborne Instruments Laboratory, was trying to build these modulators. In other words, it would take 40 gigabits per second of signal, apply it to this, what would you call it now? I can't think of the name of the Bragg cell-like device where, as you apply this very large amount of digital voltage to this device, it would act as a variable attenuator with extremely high linearity, and therefore 40 gigabits of amplitude modulation would come out of this thing when a strong piece of laser light went into it, and then that 40 gigabits per second would go down the fiber. And so, for all I know, they're into much higher modulation rates these days. Is it OC192, 10 gigs, and OC384, 40 gigs? Is that approximately what a single modulator is doing today, Eric? KE2EJ, K2RIW, wait for the beeps.
No, I got a 10 gigabit pipe in my place. That's pretty common these days. No, you can... can actually triple merge numbers to some of the main trunks now. You know, OC-192 used to be the fact of standard, but that's 10 years ago already.
And that's exactly when they were doing that work. Let me think now. Roughly 1999 to 2001 or so is when they were doing that work and really struggling with it, because the people in that industry have paid their dues, they've been there for a long time, and when a company comes along out of the blue and says, I want to do that too, me too, they've got to go through one hell of a learning curve. The electronics, it turns out the electronics that gives you that modulator absolutely, positively, cannot be capacitively coupled. Because you take a 40 gigabit or a 10 gigabit data stream and you pass it through a system, and you want the system being completely flat from 10 gigabits all the way down, from 10 gigahertz all the way down to, let me pick a number, maybe 50 kilohertz, maybe even lower than that. Because periodically you're going to get a zillion ones in a row or a zillion zeros in a row. And so what you think is a 10 gigabit square wave sometimes becomes a very broadband frequency-wide system. And if you don't do a very good job of making that amplifier flat, you can end up with tremendous kinds of timing problems, capacitive buildup. Capacitive coupling between the stages of amplification is an absolute no-no. It's got to be DC coupled. And they were fighting that battle. They were positive they could do it with AC coupling. And the answer was no way in hell. It had to be a DC coupled amplifier. You needed, I don't know the exact number, 30 or 40 decibels of gain in order to properly drive that modulator, and that driving circuit had to be thoroughly flat, otherwise you'd close up the eye diagram, if you know what I mean. My guess is you're sometimes looking at these eye diagrams. Is that true when you do that fiber optic work, Joe, to B2RYY, K2RIW in the TechNet?
Well, I just recently started learning about this, about, from where I work, but, you know, getting some exposure to it. So I don't have a lot of exposure, but it is used in a lot of locations from point to point. But it is a tremendously fascinating subject to talk about, nevertheless.
Yeah, and as you learn more about it, come back and tell us what you learned, because this is the modern way of transmitting high-speed, high-fidelity, high-bandwidth data. I hope we haven't put you to sleep, Don. It's the next person on our list. Alpha Alpha 2 November, K2RIW. Go right ahead, Don.
Thank you, sir. I have been waiting a long time, and I wait because it's interesting. I have a question if I have time, but I'd like to address the gentleman's problem with the dipole. I think all of you are all wrong. I think his problem is, matter of fact, I'd be willing to bet money on it, he has an unfortunate choice of length of coax. And here's how you can prove it. Remove the balun from the transmission line, connect it back up to your tuner, make sure that the tuner still won't tune, remove the ground from your radio, and I think you'll find the antenna tuner will work. Now, restore the ground to the radio and leave it there, and there's a couple of other methods you could use. They're a bit extreme, but you can use them. First of all, you can take the toroid out of your SWR meter and replace it with a larger toroid that you can put the coax cable through. And if there are two currents, forward and reverse, on that cable, you can read the so-called SWR on your shield. And by the way, current flows in a wire. It doesn't flow on the outside of the shield, folks. That's a misnomer. I think that's just done for explanation purposes. I disagree with that. Now, another thing you can do is you can take two toroids and set them up such that they both feed a meter. You know, run them through a diode and filter it with the capacitor, just like in your SWR meter. And you mount them in a plastic box, not a metal box, in a plastic box. You run the center conductors through one toroid and the shield to another toroid, the ground to another toroid. Both currents should read the same through the meter as you switch back and forth. Now, this is an extreme case. Now, here's the thing. Now, check the physical length of your coaxial feed to the antenna. Then check its electrical length, and you'll probably find that it's somewhere near a 40-meter frequency. Now, when this current flows up the shield, it's got two places to go, to ground and to the antenna. Since the antenna wire has an impedance, we say that's 50 ohms, if the current's going to take the path of least resistance, and if that length of that cable is the right length, it's going to go right to ground, lickety-split. That's why the bail-in fixes this problem. So that's my answer to that thing, and there's some other tests that you can make. I don't think in this case it will work, but in a less severe case, change the length of the cable, change the impedance at your tuner seats, and it will work. But if I have time for my question, let me know. Over.
Hey, you're giving us some good information there. And you could say to some degree Jeff did do that experiment you just described, Don, because he had a very difficult to tune situation before he added the ballon at the shack end, which isolated the outside of his coax cable from ground. And now the RF was able to freely flow any way it wanted to, and things became good. He's still got an unusual antenna at the far end of that cable that I'd like to see someday. I'm tempted to go visit him to see what it is, because I think I have an RFI. I have an RFEYE. In other words, when I look at antennas, because you check with my particular name and you'll find that my name is on 29 patent applications for antennas, of which about 7 or 8 of them have already been issued. So I think I know something about antenna design. I'm not an expert, but I've done a whole lot of it. And so with my RFI, my EYE, I think I know a little bit about what an antenna should look like physically in order to behave well. And therefore, I'm darn curious about seeing what Jeff's got. But go right ahead with your question, Don. We kept you waiting long enough, and go with your real question. Alpha Alpha 2 November, K2LAW in the TechNet.
Okay, I have a degree in electronics, and I've been studying antennas for years and years and years, and I think I'm one of the few people, one of the darn few people, who can explain what antennas are and how they work. It's a very simple arrangement, but we forget about our basic. I don't want to go into that, but anyways, I think I'm pretty well versed in antennas too, and I think I can design them fairly well with a minimal amount of equipment. My question is this. Why is it that our electronic equipment or the power systems are affected by the electromagnetic pulse? Now, I know what happens with this electromagnetic pulse, but I want to see if somebody comes up with the same solution that I have here as to why these things are affected by this electromagnetic pulse. Over.
When it comes to military electronics, Don, as you're probably familiar, anything that you put on an airplane must meet some fairly stiff requirements as to EMP survivability. If it's a defensive system or an offensive system on an airplane, and you're going to be flying it near the bad guys, and you're trying to do jamming, reception, whatever, you don't want an EMP situation, which could be created by lightning, or it could be created by mankind. There are kinds of offensive electronic weapons these days that are using what's called HPM, high power microwave. The Soviets are doing a little bit more of this than the United States is, where by various techniques, they've generated some really potent transmitters that can create damage to your electronics, and therefore blind you, if you know what I mean, if you're flying your airplane near their territory. They've got some ability to do that. And so, regardless of where the EMP comes from, whether it's from a nuclear event, or whether it's from lightning, or whether it's from a high-power microwave transmitter, let me drop. In either case, if the instantaneous flux density in watts per square meter, or the instantaneous E field in volts per meter, or the instantaneous magnetic field in amps per meter, you take any one of those systems of units of measuring the instantaneous peak power, and if you exceed some particular number for your particular electronics, you're going to get a failure. Each piece of wire might be picking up thousands of volts per meter on the wire, and you expose those thousands polarized front end, which can easily fry it, and after that the electronics is blinded. And so EMP is something that you've really got to worry about. There's some very fancy testing fixtures, full-size testing fixtures, where you put the whole damn airplane in this fixture, out in, I think it's in Arizona, where they've got this fixture, where you charge up a whole lot of many farads of capacitors at very high volts. You discharge it through a network that generates the EMP near your airplane, and you confirm in the real world that it will survive that EMP. So we amateurs, in theory, we're supposed to be a bit aware about this. The biggest EMP that we experience is lightning, and it may not be, let me drop it. It may not be a direct lightning strike. A direct lightning strike, which could be a number like 100,000 amperes for 20 microseconds. A really potent lightning bolt hitting your antenna directly could do that. That's the bad news. The good news is a direct strike is a hell of a lot more rare than you would think. If you used your eyes in the radio manner and you looked down on your community, you're going to see zillions of wires going up and down every one of the streets for all of the power wiring and telephone lines and whatever. As far as structures that can be conductive structures that can be struck with a lightning bolt and therefore have a easy path to ground, there's a zillion targets out there for the lightning bolt. And so for the lightning bolt to come down and select your particular antenna, unless you're in the Empire State Building, it's very, very rare. The biggest thing you and I got to worry about, and Glenn has lived with this, is that he lived near the lightning capital of the world, Gainesville, Florida. He wasn't in Gainesville, but he wasn't that far away. That's the lightning capital of the United States and maybe the world. And the thunderstorms you get almost every day give you some huge impulses of very high, spiky voltage riding on the 110-volt line coming in your house. 99% of the damage we experience is a great big spike of voltage coming in that line, and that's the main thing you have to protect from. The super conservative ham radio operator will have a whole bunch of disconnects right at where all of his coax cables come into the shack, and during a thunderstorm, he'll disconnect every one of those cables, and he'll unplug every one of his pieces of equipment from the plug in the wall. A super conservative ham will do that. Well, I'm not super conservative. I've never done that. And I've had some lightning strikes, and the lightning strikes never damaged my ham radio equipment, but it did damage my telephone system and my television set and my computing equipment. So, and many of my neighbors suffered from the exact same thing. A great big spike of voltage came into the 110-volt line. So that's a little bit about what I know on this one, Don. And you probably got a different way of looking at it. AA2, Alpha 2, November, K2RIW on the TechNet.
This is AA2A. I'm coming to you via the Internet. And the reason I asked the question was I was looking for a simple answer. The answer you gave was a very long dissertation, and I'm aware of what you say, but I don't think a lot of other people are. So I think you're wasting your time trying to use technical terms that other people don't understand. I spent 37 years with the electric company, and I am familiar with the EMP. We had an outage one time, if you recall, due to one of those things. The point I was trying to get across is grounding. These electric circuits are floating. Our electronic equipment is floating. It is not grounded, subjected to these induced voltages and current. Now, there are some amateurs that are putting their equipment, in what they think is a shield, but the shield is not grounded. If you do not ground the shield, you have no protection. Stand inside a Faraday shield one time that's not grounded. Have somebody put a little blast there and see what happens to you. So the secret is it's not grounded, and that's why these things are affected. It's a very simple answer. Okay, thanks very much. This is AA2N. Appreciate the net. It's very good.
I know that my answer was a little bit long, Don, because this is a subject that comes up periodically, and a lot of people other than you are not familiar with it. But now I'm going to hit you with a question, Don. Stand by. If you and I established a whole bunch of real good ground rods at your QTH on your property, you're sinking an EIA standard ground rod, 8 feet long, 5/8 of an inch diameter copper clad or a piece of copper rod, and you've sunk about 5 of them in various places on your property. And then with an AC ammeter type ohmmeter, AC type ohmmeter, you did confirm that the grounding resistance is 1 ohm between your various grounding rods. You have reason to believe you've got 1 ohm to the rest of the world, and that would be considered, by usual standards, an extremely good ground. 1 ohm, many of us can only get down to 3 or 4 ohms, but if you got 1 ohm of grounding, you're going to puff your chest out and you say everything's hunky-dory. Okay? Now you get a lightning bolt striking on your outside of your coax cable or your tower, and it's one of those super lightning bolts of 100,000 amperes. 100,000 amperes climbing down your tower, hitting that grounding rod of 1 ohm. By ohm's law, 100,000 amperes and 1 ohm, you've got 100,000 volts between that tower and the rest of your environment. So even with that good grounding system that you and I are now describing to each other, it gives you a lot of protection. It's not, you're not completely home free in the worst case situation. Alpha Alpha 2 November, K2LAW in the TechNet.
Okay, to answer your question, I tested and have tested many ground systems in electric substations for the very reason you're talking about. We can't have a 1 ohm of resistance on the ground system. We got to have milliohms and megohms in the ground system. Now, you didn't explain how if these ground rods are tied together and you're measuring from ground rod to ground rod and you're measuring 1 ohm, that's pretty high. So I'm not quite sure what you're saying there. But if you could be a little more specific as how these grounds are connected and how you're measuring the 1 ohm resistance, I might be able to answer your question. Over.
1 of the methods by which you would try to find out what is the grounding resistance of your system to the rest of planet Earth could be to measure the number of ohms between the various grounding rods before you connect them together with the mesh, with the grid, if you know what I mean. So measuring the individual ground rods is one way of evaluating what is your resistance to the rest of Mother Earth, and then you connect them all together. And even if you got 1 ohm in each one of your ground rods and you got 10 of them, so now we're down to 100 milliohms to Earth. 100 milliohms to Earth, 100,000 amperes, is 10,000 volts by Ohm's law, that still can do an awful lot of damage. So, yes, when you read the Polyphaser book on lightning protection techniques, and you look at all the products that they sell, from my understanding of the reading of that book, Don, I have the impression that every one of the protections you do are going to help. But if you want to think, if you think that you don't have to disconnect the cables, you don't have to unplug the equipment, because you added some real good grounds and everything's hunky-dory, as I said, you've got a lot of protection, but once in a while, Mother Nature's going to humble you, I think. Alpha Alpha 2 November, K2LAW in the TechNet.
This is AA2, and apparently you don't understand grounding. How are you going to put 10 ground rods in the ground without connecting them together? You're going to put one to some place, and the other 10, the other 9 are going to float? They're all connected together. So when you measure from one to the other, all you've got to measure is the resistance of the wires that connect them. You've got your hypothetical here doesn't carry much weight. Listen, I don't want to argue with you. You're obviously a very well inversed. What's the word? Educated individual. But sometimes you make mistakes. Like you said, and I make them too. But what with this hypothetical thing you just made up over the ground rod makes no sense at all, over.
Okay, I'm going to try again, Don. Maybe I didn't use the right words. I know that when I have this network of grounding rods on my property, I'm eventually going to connect them all together with a wire mat of some kind, a mesh, a network. I know I'm going to connect them all together. But how do I know how well the whole network is connected to Earth? How do I know that? One way of doing it is that I temporarily disconnect the wiring to all of those ground rods and measure between the ground rods in various combinations. That's one way of coming up with an assessment of how well my grounding is to the rest of Mother Earth. I temporarily disconnect some number of them and measure between them, temporarily. Then I restore all those interconnections. And so, if between various combinations of the ground rods, when they're disconnected from that grounding network, I measure half an ohm between them, or one ohm between them, and now I know that there's a total of 10 of them that I'm going to connect all together, I could come to the conclusion that maybe I've got something in the vicinity of a tenth of an ohm to Earth, of the whole network, all grounded together, all connected to each other. But for all I know, I'm sitting on top of a chunk of shale, on top of a slate. There could be all kinds of things below my property so that my conductivity to the rest of Earth could be less than perfect. And under those conditions, I can still develop some pretty big voltages on what you call ground. AA2 November, K2RIW.
The scenario you come up with makes no sense at all. Currents do flow in here. Here's what they do with the electric company. People who open and close high voltage electrical lines stand on a grate that is grounded for the simple reason that if there is a short and the current flows to ground, there is what's called a step potential. Just like you said, a lot of currents flowing in the earth and there's a potential between those and you could get electrocuted with that. We've been all through that at the electric company. This is old hat for us stuff. But what you're saying is a ridiculous test. The earth does have some resistance. You want to decrease the resistance? Put salt around each one of those ground rods. You will decrease the resistance to the earth. Won't do you any good, but you'll decrease the resistance to the earth. You're still going to get a lot of current flowing in there if you get a nearby lightning strike. But it will induce voltages even into wireless stuff. Well, I don't want to go into it. Anyway, let's leave that. It's a moot point. I disagree with you, sir, and I've been around it long enough to know different. This is AA2N. Thanks a lot.
Okay, Don, I'm now going to ask you in your area of expertise, what is the method by which you confirm how good is your grounding system to the rest of Mother Earth? You've now sunk a bunch of ground rods. You've connected them together with very low resistance, great big chunks of copper. They're all connected to each other. Those rods, in theory, are connected to Earth. Your particular piece of property may be sitting on a piece of slate or a piece of granite, which has got rather poor conductivity. So you've now established all of these ground rods. You've established all these ground rods. You've connected to each other. And now you want to know the quality of your grounding to the rest of Mother Earth. What method did you use to confirm that? Alpha Alpha 2 November, K2RIW in the TechNet.
Couple of things you can do. As I said, put salt around it, put water around it, and you can do nothing about changing it. You're stuck with what's there. All you can do is to put these grounds in the water. Into the earth. Electric substations like to be built around swamps because that's a good grounding system. So whatever kind of grounding system, whatever you have in the earth, you're stuck with. Doesn't matter how many ground rods you put in there, you're stuck with that impedance that's there, that resistance that's there. And how you measure it, I got no idea. I would never measure it. It's of no concern to me. If I have a ground rod in the ground, it's there for two reasons, an RF ground, period. As far as my radio station is concerned. In an electric system, it's a place for the return current to flow, and it flows through ground. I've had to check cables at 20,000 volts so that they would withstand the current that's flowing through the ground when these cables are in the ground. Massive currents flow in the ground, and people don't realize it, and there's nothing you can do about it. No matter what kind of ground rod you put in there, it's going to flow. It's going to return to the source. One way or the other. So whatever it is, I have no idea how you would check the value of the resistance between your ground rod. I know how to increase it, to increase its conductivity, but I have no way to check it to the earth. Between, if I put a voltmeter on my ground, an ohmmeter on my ground and stick it into the earth, what am I going to read? Is that a meaningful number? I doubt it very much, George.
KC2QIQ.
Yeah, I think think there's a way by a so-called Kelvin connection between substations where you could get at least a rough approximation, in my opinion. KC2QIQ, and then Glenn and that, Eric and after that. KC2QIQ first, KQIW, go ahead, Glenn.
Net tonight at...
Yeah, Dick, actually, one of the rules that I followed was I found an article back in an old IEC standard that seems to work pretty well, and they don't really associate this all back to ohms. How they basically do it is the standard was for grounding shelters. In other words, when you have buildings and you want to ground them, especially with these lightning problems, what they typically do is they take the height of the building or the highest part of the structure, and the grounding rods are basically supposed to be 1 10-foot rod per 10 feet of altitude. So in other words, if you had a structure like a radio antenna up in the air that's up at 40 feet, the IEC standard would say that you have to have four bonded ground rods of 10-foot ground rods at or near the base of that structure, and basically space it with 5-foot separations, minimum separations. And they actually say even separating them even wider, as long as they don't exceed the height or the altitude of the structure. So there is some correlations to how to discharge the amount of charge that's being built up on the antennas. KC2QIQ.
Thank you, Glenn. Let's see what Eric's going to say on this one. KE2EJ, where you've got to ground that tower of yours, how did you confirm that broadcast tower? How did you confirm how good of a ground it has to the rest of Mother Earth, Eric? KE2EJ, K2LIW.
K2LIW, K2EJ. We actually have a set of IEEE standards, and also there is an FAA FCC set of standards as to how you do grounding for the tower and for lightning protection. And there's actually a standard setup. We use 10-foot rods with a certain minimum spacing in a ring configuration. And there is actually a standard which says that you drive a ground rod in at one point, you go X number of feet away, you drive another ground rod in, and you measure the number of ohms, which also gives you the quality number for the actual material in the earth. As you know, Long Island, once you start getting down a little bit deep, it's mostly sand, which is not a very good conductor. So there's a lot of different things that you can do to get around those issues. K2RW, K2J.
So let's run that by again, Eric. What I think I heard you say is that there's an EIA standard, IEEE standard, by which you confirm the quality of the ground by sinking a ground rod in one position, sinking another one some given distance away, measure the number of ohms between them as a method of assessing the quality of your grounding rods in that particular example. And that's sort of what I was saying earlier, and Don didn't think that was the right way to go. And I think you're saying there is an IEEE standard that measures the quality of the grounding system by comparing two separate rods at a known distance between them. KE2EJ for a confirmation. K2LIW in the TechNet.
IWK2EJ, yes, that's correct. Not only is it an IEEE standard, but that standard is also utilized by the FAA and the FCC. So it's a multitude of government organizations that agree with that standard. There's also an electrical code, in part of the National Electrical Code, that also has a specification that's somewhat similar, but a little bit different. And by the way, the grounding that we're talking about is for lightning, not RF grounding.
Yeah, when we do grounding, we're doing it for three reasons. Number one, lightning protection. Number two, human protection. Number three, improving RF characteristics. And so the first two are the dominant ones. Lightning protection and human protection are the main reasons we do all kinds of fancy grounding with the third prong on our plug in the wall and so on. Okay, we're going to move on. I think we've answered the questions of the people who signed in. I know others were trying to sign in, and sorry to say we couldn't do it on that section of the TechNet so far. We're going to go over to the mailbag now, and a lot later than we normally do. Looks like we've been lollygagging here, John. KC2WGB, K2RIW in the TechNet, go right ahead.
NY2H for quick comment.